7:08 in the morning. You are listening Up Front. I'm Kat Brooks.
And I'm Brian Edwards Tiegert back in the studio.
Welcome back, Brian.
Did I miss anything?
You missed us making our fun drive goal and actually surpassing our fun drive goal thanks to our amazing listeners. Thank you to everybody who ensured that we survived to live on another day.
Wow. Sounds like it was a good thing I took some time off.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And Mitch, when we were pitching together, the way he got people to donate was telling them that your job was on the line. So. he was serious.
I already got him out of the building.
But you both missed something on Thursday. Let's not forget that.
What did we miss on Thursday?
I don't know. Your show?
The Mitch Show?
Oh, did you host
on
Thursday?
Oh, I was here. Oh, you didn't even listen.
No, I didn't.
Good morning, by the way.
Good morning. Mitch Jezerich is in the studio with us. It's Mondays with Mitch.
Yes.
It was a tape show, right? We left you prepared.
Oh, no. Corinne, your producer is a beast, Corinne Smith. It was partly tape. We definitely had a lot of tape in there. But Corinne was very deliberate in getting reporters both in Dayton as well as in El Paso to talk about the day after Trump went to go visit those places.
And he went to go visit those. And am I correct? He went to go visit the shooting victims in El Paso, Texas, and they refused to see him. From all the reports that I saw, they refused to see him. And then while he was visiting them, he at the same time was unleashing ICE agents in Mississippi.
Yeah, 680 people were detained. I think some have actually since been released, but it's the
300.
Yeah, it's the largest raid in over an immigration raid in over a decade, and also and one of the largest of that have ever occurred. So that's interesting. You know, if you look at some of the numbers of the people that were detained, look like 400 of them, over 400 were people from Guatemala. Which is interesting to think about. And then also, at the same time, a study came out from a couple of universities that are looking into Donald Trump and Trump's administration's practices with employers and how it's handling employers who hire undocumented immigrants. And it is found that actually actions against employers are down from previous administrations. So it's kind of interesting, and I'm not trying to promote that, you know, everyone should go after employers. But what I'm trying to say is that it's been a one-way street for immigration enforcement with this administration. It has not been going it has been going less after employers and corporations that hire folks than the workers themselves.
But that was the left-wing news, you know, left-wing liberal wing news line throughout most of the weekend was that the employers were the ones that should be being arrested and or punished for hiring undocumented people and not the undocumented people.
Or people should just be allowed to work here.
Right. People should just be allowed to work here, pay taxes, send their children to school. The children are the stories that are really sort of dominating the news headlines right now that came home from school. It's their first day of school in Mississippi, went to school and came home to having no parents. And so now there are hundreds of children, either with a family or not with any family, that have no idea where their parents are.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I haven't seen reporting on is like kind of the collateral consequences, like how many people didn't show up to other jobs, adjacent jobs the next day out of fear, like how many people went into hiding. But I think it's always worth bearing in mind that when you think about immigration policy like these raids, the spectacle is the point, right? About 12 million undocumented people living in this country who theoretically could be deported, but it's logistically impossible. Even if you threw every due process the Trump administration wants to get rid of to the wind. So, you know, the terror, the spectacle is the point. The only way like the white nationalist wing of the Trump administration has a serious impact on like who is part of this society is by forcing people into hiding.
Right. That's right. You mentioned El Paso and Ohio. They have reignited again the gun debate.
Yeah. And right now, the Congress is on break, of course, conveniently so. So the House of Representatives before, the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives, has approved several measures concerning gun control, including expanding universal background checks and other things as well. And they are, and Democrats are calling on Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, to hold a special session to call the Senate back and to vote on those bills that the House has already approved. Mitch McConnell says he's not going to do that, which is not surprising. Again, they are in August recess. Some are on vacation. Some are also just in their district. You know, there used to be a time where Congress was basically in session almost like 360 of the 365 days of the year. And then in the 1970s, there was a law passed by Congress saying, wait a minute, there should be a break in the legislative business, that people should be back in their districts and spend more time back in their districts. And certainly there are lawmakers that are using this time as vacation, but it's also a time where you go back to your district, where you meet people within your district, you have town halls and all of these type of things. So this is the August recess. It happens every year in August. They won't be back until after Labor Day. So Mitch McConnell last week said that he will not be calling the Senate back into session. However, that they are negotiating and having discussions right now. And I guess even Nancy Pelosi has met with Donald Trump via the telephone concerning certain type of packages that they might be considering once the Senate and the House comes back. It's not surprising to me that Mitch McConnell is not going to have the Senate vote on the Democratic bills that came from the House of Representatives, because that's just going to politically look like he's capitulating to them. They may even write many of the same things. Who knows what ends up coming out? Who knows what the appetite is now, 4 weeks from now? But they could potentially have very similar measures that just aren't sponsored by Democrats, right, that they can take credit for, that they would come out with. And it seems like the one thing that there is large agreement on is the universal background checks. Now, my understanding, and I'm not an expert on these kind of things, but my understanding is this only applies to commercial sales of guns, not between private individuals, which it seems like the Republicans are taking a firm line on about private sales of guns.
Most of the illegal sales happen. Just from individual to individual.
Yeah, well, they're already illegal.
Right.
So, yeah. So we'll see what happens when it comes back. It's possible that I could see, you know, we're just playing sort of inside baseball here, but what could stall anything from happening? Is it possible, even though it seems like there's momentum now, and of course it is possible, this could all stall? Again, how do people feel a month from now? How much attention is put on these issues a month from now? Furthermore, I could also foresee a situation where the Republicans are saying, okay, we are going to support, you know, this version of universal background checks, but nothing more. And then the Democrats will be in the Democrats' ball. The ball will be in the Democrats' court. Do you just go with the little gains that you can get, which is better than nothing? Or do you see this as a more important moment where you could try to put, because the Democrats would like to have a ban on assault weapons, semi-automatic assault weapons. That's something that the Republicans probably are not going to get behind. I could see a scenario where the Republicans, like I said, okay, we're going to move forward with background checks, but we're not going to do this other stuff. And then the Democrats objecting to that because it's not enough. So that's a potential way this could all stall.
I mean, it's interesting that the backdrop to this is that the NRA, is the National Rifle Association, is in complete disarray. You know, members of its own board are suing the organization. The organization is spending millions of dollars on lawyers. It's losing donors left and right. It's being investigated by New York Attorney General Letitia James because it's incorporated as a nonprofit in New York. So they get to ask whether you're doing with your donors' money what you told them you were going to do, who could very well shut it down as a consequence of the investigation. And I wonder how much an impact that has on Republicans' malleability, because there's no one kind of like playing the whip role herding people into line, saying there's going to be consequences if you move at all towards a gun control position.
But I think Donald Trump's base plays that whip. I think it's his base. His base hold those values. I have a right to my guns. I have a right to this. I have a right to that. And I think that that would hurt Republicans, and they know that. You start trying to take away their guns.
I mean, it's interesting because there's about like 80% support for sensible gun control, things like universal background check and public opinion polls. His base, like his approval rating at least, is in the 40s somewhere. So there's definitely some people in his base who would like to see something like universal background checks. Historically, the issue has been like the gun people just care a lot more. So they will let that one issue define how they vote, right? Whereas people who maybe would like to see gun control are voting on other stuff, like whatever he's saying he's going to do about trade or the white nationalism, the racism, right? But I think it's important that...
But I would tie the white nationalism to the guns.
Yeah?
That those two groups live together.
A lot of overlap.
Yeah.
I think the NRA did play that role of kind of alerting the base, organizing the base, telling them who to punish and who to call and why and so forth.
Right.
And if they're kind of becoming a diminished organization and someone who it's maybe toxic for lawmakers to get too close to on corruption, not on politics, it could start to move things on a policy level.
I try to see how this would play out. I mean, there's a level of violence and violent rhetoric that is sweeping through a segment. Not all gun owners fall into this category by any means at all. I don't want to get the flood of emails I get from listeners about my support of gun ownership. But actually, you can email me. It's fine. But I do support I do support gun ownership. You know, but you listen, I track some of the white right stuff and like the things that they say about, you know, come take my guns. And we've seen them willing to go out and commit mass shootings. I'm bracing myself. And I know other people of color are and progressives, like bracing ourselves for the next wave of violence. And I think that strict, not that I think we're even going to see it, but I do think that strict gun control are trying to take people's guns away. I would be more concerned about what that looks like in the streets. How that plays out, how Donald Trump riles up his base to respond to that.
Yeah.
That to me is scary.
I mean, I think it's also pretty predictable. It's going to be increased policing at big public events.
Right.
Right. At every level right. of government as a response to this. And we'll probably get that in lieu of most meaningful.
That wasn't
types
even
of
a public
control.
Event, right? Like people were at Walmart, mm-hmm. for God's sake. And I always think it's important to remind people that that dude bought his gun legally. Mm-hmm. Right, he broke no laws to get that weapon.
There was Gilroy, though. That was a public event. That was at the Garlic Festival. I think it's an interesting point that you bring up because we had a number of big events just this past weekend. You know, regardless if most of these happen at events or not, we had a number of big events this last weekend, including music events and festivals in San Francisco. And it really stood out to me as I was watching television news, local television news leading into that, those events and giving them coverage. What dominated the coverage of that is all the extra security that was going to be at these events. And it wasn't questioning the extra security. It was just one person after another saying, well, I'm really happy that we're going to have all the police here, that we're going to have all these measures here. It's going to make me feel safe. And maybe it does. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if people feel that way.
People that look like me don't feel that way.
But it and
people look like me do not feel that way.
Understood. And but you can see a result of all this. I think you're getting at here is that this leads towards more of a kind of a police state, more of a security state than it already has. I mean, you just think how things have changed since 9/11. We're so used to these things, and so many people have just grown up with it where it seems normal. But if you think about the world, how our world was before 9/11, it's a pretty dramatic difference there.
I was having that conversation coming home in the airport yesterday, right? The going through the TSA and the garbage and the frustration with all of that. And just like, it wasn't like this, you know, it just wasn't like this. And you're protecting us from who?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, after other mass shootings, it's completely bizarre and appalling that, like, we've had this conversation multiple times. But we kind of go through the recitals on gun statistics to put things in perspective. The majority of gun deaths in this country are not mass shootings. They're suicides.
And then right behind that, intercommunal violence.
Right.
And domestic violence.
Domestic violence. So it's important not to kind of, you know, from a public health standpoint, give so much weight to the mass shootings. But I do think from like a public psychology standpoint, from like a cultural impact, it is. I mean, I still can't wrap my head around the fact that every kid growing up today goes through active shooter drills at their school. Like, I don't know what that does to you growing up. I think about the way my parents talk about doing nuclear bomb drills when they were growing up, which I didn't have to do by the time I was growing up.
You're only a year younger than me. I had to do nuclear bomb drills.
You were close to a military.
Yeah, I didn't even. I'm older than you.
And
but
you never.
Barely.
But I lived in Nevada. To Brian's point, I lived in Nevada and we had a test site there.
Yeah.
So it was a thing.
But also, you know, the kind of embrace of like massively ramped up policing and security measures in public spaces and gathering spaces and fear of going to gathering points. I mean, I saw this particularly on like Latinx Twitter. You know, this is the biggest terrorism act to target the Latinx community in the United States in its history, right. El Paso.
And I mean, I hate to say it, but I think we need to be bracing ourselves for more. I've said it on this show a number of times, and I've said it in conversation with both of you. There was an uptick in violence against people of color and queer folks and immigrants from the time Trump started stumping earnestly in 2016, and it did not even start to fade until, you know, a few months into his administration, and I think we're going to see it again.
Right. And you always
and we don't know what that's going to look like. We don't know if that's going to be more mass shootings or it's just going to be, you know, hate action. But we need to be bracing ourselves and we need to be prepared to defend ourselves and our communities.
Before we leave this topic, I just want to go back to the NRA. I'm not ready to count them out yet. I don't disagree with you whatsoever. You're absolutely right that they've been hurt recently and continue to be so. But we haven't really seen them defeated yet in the legislative arena or the legal arena as of yet. And I just, you know, it'll always stay with me when I was a Capitol Hill reporter in 2004. It could have been 2004, 2005. I get them all mixed up now. But the Senate was on the verge of approving a measure that was going to give immunity to gun manufacturers. And it was such a far gone conclusion because both Democrats and Republicans were in the NRA was in both of their pockets. It was such a far gone conclusion. But the vote was going to happen right at my deadline. So I just did the story anyways as though it was going to pass. And then 10 minutes before they voted, Dianne Feinstein successfully got added as an amendment to that bill, the renewal of and the prolonging of the assault weapons ban. And then within 5 minutes, the NRA sent out an email to all the congressional members saying, we now oppose this. And the bill went down in flames just like that. And my story still went out there, at least in the first feed.
Ooh, that's rich.
Yeah, no, that was a different issue right there. But I guess
not the point of the story.
But I don't do that anymore.
The point is, don't trust him.
I thought that was already a given. But my bigger point is, and I'm not saying the NRA is as strong politically right now as it was then, but I haven't seen them actually defeated in the arena yet. And I don't think I would count them out yet.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if this is the round. But I do think in parallel, there's probably more institutional might on the gun control side of the ledger than there has been in my lifetime.
That's right. I agree completely.
You know, groups like the Gifford Center, headquartered here in San Francisco, Moms Demand Action, which has been doing popular organizing, the kids who survived the Parkland shooting, who have become celebrity activists in their own right and built organization with other young people across the country. So we'll see.
But I've never seen any group have the political power that I've seen the NRA have on the Hill. So I agree with everything you said, but I want to, they haven't been defeated yet. So
I just want to take the last couple of minutes of Mondays with Mitch and talk about Jeff Epstein a little bit, who successfully, second suicide attempt, he was successful at it. Apparently he tried to commit suicide, they put him on suicide watch, then they took him off of suicide watch, and he successfully committed suicide in the Manhattan jail. The news cycle, though, was about, somehow it's always about Donald Trump. And I'm not going to read the stupid tweet that he retweeted to his 63 million Twitter followers.
Well, what did he do? What did he tweet? Come on. So, I didn't see it.
You didn't see it?
No.
So some comedian, I'm using air quotes, y'all, did a tweet basically accusing the Clintons of having Jeff Epstein murdered inside of his jail cell.
Is that the one where Hillary Clinton's leaning into Bill Clinton and the meme says, it's done?
Yes.
Yeah.
And then Trump retweeted that to 63 million people, which has unleashed this whole thing of conspiracy theories. And, of course, because of who Jeff Epstein was, from high school dropout to teacher to all of a sudden a money manager worth over $500 million with connections to both Donald Trump and Bill Clinton, there's already conspiracy theories about what you'll sure. find in the documents. You know, there's thousands and thousands of documents. He was accused of sex trafficking. This was the second accusation. The first one in 2007, he avoided prison time through a non-prosecution agreement that his victims weren't made aware of. This time people were sure he was going to go to prison, but there's thousands and thousands of documents, and because of who he was, there's lots of conspiracy about what other names are going to come out in those documents, and people are running scared.
Well, even beyond the documents, what about the conspiracies of what died with him?
Right.
What information
what
died
will
with
never
him,
know.
Which we'll never know.
Yep.
It was sort of a feeling this weekend, and I'm actually trying to stay as far away from this story as I can. It's wild.
But I think it's important to talk about, not because of him, but because of the survivors. Yeah. That there are dozens and dozens of survivors who, A, feel like they were robbed of justice, right? And I don't want to do not email me about abolition and all that in this case. But feel like they're going to be denied justice. These are mm-hmm. some of the same victims that were shocked, weren't made aware of the non-prosecution agreement in 2007. And so it's important to talk about predators, and it's important to talk about the safety nets that they find inside of the socioeconomic paradigms of the society, and the fact that he had access to the number of people that were able to help him perpetrate this massive sex trafficking ring for all of these years. So I do think, I mean, it's a balance between, right, we don't want to glorify or give Jeff Epstein a ton of time, but I do think the story is important, and I do think it's important to track what is going to come out. What are we going to find out? Who is going to be implicated? And then, you know, there, of course, will be the civil suit. The criminal case will go on with the people that were conspirators, is that the right word? Mm-hmm. Including women that did recruiting for him. And then the civil case will proceed over his, I think it's $550 million assets.
Yeah. And I think it is worth pointing out, since what died with him has crossed a lot of people's minds and lips, that's strictly what was in his head. Him dying actually makes it easier for those documents to see the light of day. Mm. Because his lawyers had been preparing challenges that the search, like the warrants weren't in order for the searches they executed to get those documents, and had a decent chance of prevailing, which would have kept that stuff out of the public eye. But he was the only person withstanding to bring that challenge. Mm. Like, the people who are named in those documents can't challenge whether or not the search was legitimate. So that's actually a legal hurdle to getting those documents in the record removed by his passing.
All right,
Mitch. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, we'll continue to track it.
Yeah. I just couldn't believe this past weekend. I was just like, by the looks of what happened this weekend, it's like, oh no, is this going to be the conspiracy theory? The next great big conspiracy theory that lives on?
Right. Yes.
Yep.
It is.
It's a pretty sick one, right?
Yep. Coming up next, we are going to continue conversation about the ICE raids that happened in Mississippi. We're going to talk to Bill Chandler, the executive director of the Mississippi Immigrants' Rights Alliance. And then we're going to look at the recycling crisis. The largest recycling plant in California has shut its doors, laying off over 700 people.
That's all next.
After the news.